This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Rasland. Today we have the returns of video producer here at BFM, Rahma Fawzi.
Hi, thank you for having me here today.
Hi, great to have you. And we have also the return of, he's a writer, director, and he's an actor. He is Naar Murad.
Thanks, hi, good to be back.
And our three topics this week are, topic number one is ancestry. Topic number two is changing words. And finally, topic number three will be cinema of attraction.
Action-packed episode.
Yeah, yeah. So with the first topic, ancestry, I am writing a thing at the moment. And it involves, well, it involves like the world of the 1890s, but also my own personal family history at that time. And I met up with my uncle, who really knows our family history. And so now I know my ancestry on my Malay side. So now I know up to my grandfather's grandfather, a man who was born, we think, around 1865, up in Kuala Kangsar in Perak. And I know his children. I know his wives. I've got a picture of my grandfather's grandfather. I now know better about my grandfather. And I know this line. And I could know a little bit further, but it gets a little bit murky beyond that. Meanwhile, on my mother's side, the British side, it's much easier to...
it's the family name, isn't it?
You can
use it. Registries and stuff.
That's right. And people have been written down in church registries and whatnot since, you know, in Roman times or whatever.
And those censuses too.
Censuses and all
so
that.
And so-and-so beget so-and-so.
Yeah. But my mother's side, though, very anonymous, working class, rural people from Wales and Devon. And I have their names, and I've read newspapers from where they were and everything. So, but and they're fascinating stories. But I wonder when I find out about these people, especially when I find out about my Malay side, I can't help but wonder, who are they to me and who am I to them? Do I owe them some kind of obligation? People always say, oh, you must know your roots. But I feel like so different from these people. And is it? I'm just sort of feeling like it's just sort of fun to know who these people were. Or am I related to them? I mean, do I owe them some, should I be all kind of really like Malay nationalist about it? It's like, you know, I know my roots now and I know where I came from. And
you're not sure how you should feel about
I'm
it.
I'm not for sure how I should feel about it.
Yeah, and
it's fascinating. I love it. But I mean, you guys like Rahma, I mean, do you know your family history way back?
Yeah, so it's interesting because my dad has this, I wouldn't call it obsession, but almost like his fascination. And this is something that he really likes doing, which is to find out about the family roots. And he's gone as far as going to Riau, Indonesia, and also to the southern part of Thailand, just to try to talk to people who kind of know the person of, you know, daughter, son, grandmother or something like that, just to find out how they were related. And he came up with this family tree, I think. And this is like a quest sort of that he's been going on since I was like 12, because my grandmother, when she was still around, she did not really like going to places to visit. Like, you know, it's not like, oh, I want to go to the zoo, or I want to go to, like, I don't know, theme park, or, you know, like, it's not that kind of stuff. But what he liked to do, what she liked to do is to go for visitation. So she would be on the motorbike with my late grandfather from Penang all the way to Kelantan regularly, just to trace down this families.
Wow.
So I think my dad just kind of like
inherited
that and see pleasure in that and understanding that. But to answer your question, what I notice is, you know, at least like within our family and, you know, with him, is that there's a sense of like, you know, like it's humbling to kind of know where you're from. So it doesn't have to mean that you have to adopt certain roots or whatever. And like the fact that we also kind of know that we have like some Yemeni ancestry kind of like made my dad like sees us, okay, no wonder your eyes like that, Rama. No wonder your eyelashes are like that. So it's just like kind of nice to kind of know where your little things come from. But I think more than anything, it's just humbling to really know who you are, to really know your roots. You don't really necessarily have to, like, a certain way.
You don't have to change your
Yeah, it's just kind of like makes yourself fuller. It's like a wholesome
understanding of just history in general. But I also, like, even today I'm learning that, you know, like, so much Yemeni here in Malaysia, like, you know, several generations back for me. So fist bump right here.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So
many different things. Like, for example, my grandmother, my late grandmother, my maternal grandmother, and my aunt and my sister went back to Jawa Timur, Kampung, I don't know if I can pronounce it, Ngampel or something like that. And they found out all kinds of interesting things. And it's just nice to know that these people actually had lives, but also invariably their lives were always richer in some way. I always feel that our lives are kind of like everything is, you don't have to be, you know, like of the upper class or whatever, but we are so much more entitled now than then. Almost invariably, even the ones who did well had to struggle so much. And it gives you that kind of, I don't know, I feel kind of grateful that he survived, basically. I mean, I don't know how to explain it to Cam, but you know, on my father's side, also a lot of interesting stuff. And then you're right about the whole thing. I have a great-grandfather who was from Liverpool. And we could, just from his name, trace him all the way back to Normandy before the 1066.
Wow.
And the Mondays, they're spelled many, many ways, like Monday. They came from Mondayville up in Normandy. And after the war, they were knights and they fought. And so they were given land in Derbyshire, I think, or whatever, to grow cucumbers. I don't know, I can't remember what it was. So I don't feel any connection with that. I don't want to grow cucumbers. But
I don't know. But then when you're like reading a book, do you feel like, oh, I'm on that team? I'm reading about the Norman invasion. Go Normans.
Most English people would hate me, right?
Yeah.
Go like, yeah, you
that Robin Hood. Boo. I don't know. Is it?
It's interesting. It's interesting because it connects you with things. I mean, I don't know much about the Yemen, but now when I think about what's going on in the Yemen, I feel that it hurts a little bit more knowing
and kind of like could have been
I've
you,
got
you know, but
that blood in
yeah.
me. You know, yeah. My great grandfather could have stayed there and or in fact I might even have relatives there. I just don't know.
So it's enriching.
It is enriching. Yeah.
All right, what if and I haven't found this, by the way, I haven't found this on my family side. What if I discovered that one of my family members was like, you know, Nazi death camp warden or I mean, something like really
serial
bad.
Killer.
Serial killer. I mean how then? Like a genuinely bad person by any measure.
It'd be very convenient for you to justify any naughty thing that you ever do. Like, I can't help it, it's in my genes. No, I don't know, yeah. That would be scary. But I'm sure they were. We quite avoid it.
Yeah,
do you know
yeah.
that actually, if you were to have a book the size of a phone book, for example, and you had those little pictures like you have in your college graduation, whatever, right? If you traced one line of your family, let's just say mother, it only would take 5,000 pictures for us to get back to where we were all connected in the Rift Valley in Africa. Only 5,000 pictures or something like that.
Mm.
So, or very close to that. So when you think about it, you know, our connections is not that vast and unthinkable. If I had that phone book, you had that phone book, and we would go through these faces, before we got to 5,000, we would find connections in the Yemen, in God knows where.
Yeah.
All over the place.
Wow. You okay. know? Well, move on. But kids, ask your grandparents what a phone book is. And while you're talking to them, ask them where they came from.
It's not Kindle. Okay, I'm not talking about Kindle. It's not a phone book.
What are pages?
What are pages? Photos?
What is the number?
Okay. You could learn so much from
Normandy?
Us kids. Exactly. Well, there you go. I'm going to continue with my research. And
good luck.
I'm enjoying it. But we move on, though, to another aspect of change, changing words.
Changing words, yeah, and how it annoys people. Well, you know, like everybody, all of you here would have an example of how a word would have changed. So I'll start it off with my favorite, which is the word awful. The word awful used to be a positive word. It's like full of awe. It's
is
something
it really?
That makes you, yeah. But awe does not have to be, it could be a frightening awe too. But if you were to see an opera singer wave, I don't know how old this word, when it changed to become awful, became awful, became terrible. But it meant something that gave you awe. So if you see an opera singer and she's singing
that
brilliantly, that was awful, you would say back in, I don't know, 1783. And now you go like, well, what have you got against her? It's that change, I don't know why it changed. There must have been people who got irritated when it changed. Perfectly good word, and now it's, you know, something else.
The word terrible actually is the same.
So it used to mean something good?
Well, I mean, yeah, it would be to fill you with terror. Terror wouldn't be like, oh my God, I'm so scared, but more like,
oh, okay. Oh,
like it's so overwhelming that it's terrible.
Interesting that awful has been replaced by awesome, which basically means the same thing, but now awesome is good. Okay. I mean, it's the whole thing, like, you know, like you go, like, now people go bad. Oh, that's so bad. That's so nasty. That's so, you know, that's so sick. Bad words that mean bad things have become good things because it's cool to be bad. I don't know.
Yeah.
But moving on, it's like lately I've been noticing a lot of people who are involved in or have family with or they work in psychotherapy or medicine, like the word triggered has been sort of like softened to the point where, you know, you would go, you know, my mom said I can't cook, so I was like so triggered. And it's like you get annoyed a little bit and it's like you're triggered. Well, a lot of people...
Oh my God, you got a scene as face right now.
but people who realize that, because I have a friend whose daughter has epilepsy.
Mm.
And she's always talking about what triggers the epilepsy, which is heat or whatever. And that same goes for mental health and mental illness. And these are serious topics. And a lot of people, when they say the word triggered, they're talking about something as something which is very, very important and very, very dark to them. And yet now the word triggered has just, it's just been thrown around. And I understand that frustration, that sometimes a word that means something to you or something more serious to you has become frivolous, right?
Wow.
So I have a few. I have a few which I'm sure you guys have to. I'll try to be quick. One is the word meta. There are two basic meanings for meta, but the original meaning from the Greek, meta would mean something that's beyond what you understand. Or something, a meta ant would be a super ant of some sort. It's beyond what you expect an ant to be. Much later, it became something that's meta would mean something that discusses itself, like mathematics is mathematics that is about mathematics. So then it became a theater thing where if you're self-referential, you break the fourth wall, it becomes meta. That started to irritate me a little bit, but it's still following the...
That's pretty recent.
That is pretty recent. But I'm not, yeah, about 20 years. But it's still a good use of meta. For me, for my generation, it was metaphysics, meta-human, meta this. It always meant something. It was a scientific or pseudo-scientific term to mean something extraordinary, an extraordinary version of something. A meta phone wouldn't mean a phone that references itself, but a phone which is beyond being a phone. It does, you know, it can call the fourth dimension or whatever. And now it's becoming even more, almost as bad as triggered. It's reached a point where, you know, somebody says something halfway clever. Oh man, he's so meta, right?
But I mean, people who are growing up now and are first introduced to the word in its new form, would treat it as that this is the way.
Absolutely,
it is.
Yeah.
And they would look at you as going,
why
are you so frustrated?
What's your problem, Daddy-O?
What's so meta-human? I know, because the thing is, it's what you're used to. It's the same thing. Another one for me is meme. The term meme doesn't really irritate me, but meme was started by Richard Dawkins, right? And it's a evolutionary term, which means something that's not genetic, but something that's passed down mentally as a memory that actually does the same kind of changes that a genetic change would to a species or to a culture.
Like a man-made thing.
Not a man-made thing, but a piece of information, a sign, a signal.
So like learning fire.
Like, for example, our shared 5,000 pictures ago, great-grandparents would see a snake. And we've always had nice snakes in this neighborhood, but this one bit me. And you tell everybody, like, that snake, black, yellow dots, it bit me. Mm. It's aggressive. This passes down, and that becomes a meme. A meme which actually, because that happens, and everybody will start killing that snake or something, it causes a change, where even a discovery of a particular tool is a meme because it changes you. Okay, so that's meme basically in its most general form, and it's changed. Whoa. There's meme this and meme that.
I can see it as a series of pictures, you know, a guy looking at a girl.
Yeah, and now we all know what a meme is, right? Yeah. But the thing is, with that definition of meme, yes, it does spread within a culture, and it spreads quickly. It's a piece of information that everybody starts to see. But unfortunately, memes are different from what a meme was then, because everybody forgets a meme 10 minutes Later.
Well, yeah, but I mean, Richard Dawkins only invented it a short while ago anyway. So.
Yeah, over 90s, yeah. But it's quickly, and a lot of people have disputed it. I'm just thinking that the word meme itself has a nice, for me, it has a nice meaning. And but the funny thing is, the actual term meme as a piece of a picture or a saying on the internet, that to me is a meme. A meme is a meme. So suddenly it's become...
It's a thing on its own. It's, yeah.
Because... Actual individual memes to me are not memes. The actual idea of a meme, because it's something that everybody depends on now, and everybody learns to like absorb that piece of information to the point that aside from other kinds of bursts of information we have on the internet, it's actually changing the way we're all thinking. So it is, the meme itself as a whole is a meme. It is changing.
Can I say something though?
Yeah, sure.
This is so meta.
Okay, do you have guys have other words that irritate you? Other words that have changed that irritates you?
I'll jump in very quickly. One word that I recently discovered, nitty gritty.
Yeah.
It changed me insofar as I don't want to use this word anymore because I've discovered that nitty gritty is the word that was given to the stuff that was at the bottom of a slave ship. When it arrived in the Americas. So it was the feces, the blood, the urine, the dead bodies.
Wow.
So when you go down to the nitty gritty, it was originally said, literally, boy, go down to the nitty gritty and clean it.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And then in time, it became a figure of speech.
I cannot really think of anything, but I do have one thing to say, which is, isn't that how words supposed to evolve to begin with, right? And I think there's also like about owning and having to pass the ownership to someone else, or like after a while you like lose control about it. And it's a cultural. I think like the malleability of a culture is what's encapsulating, you know, that how words are being used and transferred and retranslated.
But generation after generation, there will be those who will be irritated by a change.
And I'm afraid, I mean, like, I'm not sure if I, like, if this is like a good space to bring this up, but of course it all has a lot to do with power and status quo and all that. So the fact that how, like, it was like, for example, like, I thought about the word triggered when you first mentioned it to me. And I just thought that, okay, what an exclusive term. Like, I'm trying to, like, you know, make people be more aware of what this means. And the moment it gets out there, because, like, mental health is also, like, kind of conversation that you can have a bit more easily, I guess. Like, or at least people are more aware of it. They take ownership with everything, with all access and, you know, the content of the baggage of mental health, right? Along with the word triggered. You know, I'm not sure if I'm making sense.
They who?
Meaning like the people, like
what
the society. What involved, whatever that comes with the notion, the mental health notion, everyone literally just scoop it out and along with the word triggered and they mainstream it somehow and that got translated. So, I don't know, like I just think
that... their fault.
It's not their fault. What I'm trying to say is just like that's just how words evolve, and that speaks to the notion of power, mostly because obviously who holds the megaphone is the people who can basically rewrite or like retranslate these words.
But I'm holding the megaphone now, so we have to move on.
No, but can I ask a favor from you guys? Yeah. Please don't use tren again. I want to go back to kretapi. Okay, kretapi is a cool word. What's tren?
Is
it now tren?
Tren now.
That's true.
Is it?
Yeah.
So it would be kapata. It'd be plane, and then it would be kapal.
Yeah,
or whatever.
But you're right.
Yeah, we haven't done Malay at all, but we've just been sticking to English. Well, I think the so far our two topics are related, and let's find out if topic number three is related in turn when we return here to a bit of culture on BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Naa Murad, and Rahma Pauzi, and now Rahma. The cinema of attraction.
Yeah, so not related to
whatever that we just talked about. Anything with Scarlett Johansson to me is cinema of attraction.
Oh my God, you might be true. Cinema of attraction. So I've always been fascinated. I mean, I like stories and I like films ever since I was a kid. But I do like one particular kind of film, and that is documentary films because I'm a nerd like that.
So that's what you do, right?
Yeah, that's what I do. And so growing up, I just could not bring myself to liking Fast and Furious, for example, and movies that have a lot of...
you're not abnormal. This is quite
a lot of explosives in it. But at the same time, I think maybe like during my teenage years, I started watching like a few short videos that were made in like 1900s. And they looked so different from the black and white films that I thought I knew about, which is like, you know, Charlie Chaplin films. Like, to me, that was like silent films. So these were like these silent films. So this is before D.W. Griffith, before we put narration into our stories. So
before the camera even knew how to move.
Yes, like exactly. Yeah. And then so I went to college, and then there's like I learned about this thing called cinema of traction, and I thought it was really interesting because the history of early cinema has always been theorized under the hegemony of narrative films, hence the films that I was describing to you guys just now, which was made in 1910s and 1900s, were called primitive cinema. Why was it called primitive cinema? Because basically these films were just like a bunch of illusionists and people who love magic tricks and just like performing magic tricks in front of the camera, or people who were bodybuilders who just want to show up their muscles and flexing around. And there's another men and women who just like, I just want to show you how to kiss. And they literally just kiss. And it felt like a like early age of YouTube. And it was just like, And that's why this was theorized.
Having fun with a new technology.
Yeah, exactly. And this was why it was called the primitive cinema. Because, oh, these people do not know how to make movies. There's no narrative in this. But actually, it's considered as like cinema of attraction. So the way that cinema was treated back in those days with Georges Méliès, I'm not sure. So this film called A Trip to the Moon.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's just like he was an illusionist and a French illusionist and literally performing magic tricks. And the stories that kind of like bind one magic trick to the next magic trick was just there.
Puff of smoke, something disappears.
Yeah, it's to serve the purpose of this magic trick. So he basically derived the magic tricks first. Then, okay, how can we thread the narrative along this one action to another? So people went to cinema at that time because of the value of attraction, to be fascinated, to feel the pleasure, to enjoy.
Be astonished.
Be astonished, to look at spectacle. So the narration almost doesn't matter because it's just a tool for you to showcase the special effects. And what that reminds you of is obviously Fast and Furious, right?
Yeah.
So it's
because it's like, wow, look at those cars.
Yeah,
look at that muscle.
Exactly.
They do that kind of.
Yeah,
it's like watching Evel Knievel jump over the canyon. It's like you want to see something which you have no grasp of how it's done.
Right.
So
So it's interesting because the reason why we didn't see these movies with full of explosions or like super heaty sex scenes or whatever, we don't see them as cinema of attraction just because they have narrative, you know, that's like treading around these actions. So and cinema in the sense is less about telling stories but more about a way to present a series of fascinating views to the audience. I found that interesting that like literally like 100 years plus later we go back to that. So that's when I realized that, okay. And I guess like that's how we enjoy cinema. It's like it's different. I enjoy cinema differently. Like I look at the shots. I look at how one scene moves to the next. But some people are just there for the explosions, and that is fine because that is the form. That is the medium of the art.
Because that's why scriptwriters are treated so badly, because nobody really listens to what is it they do those words.
So if it's just like a bunch of like YouTube videos lined up together and it's kind of like it is cinema. So it's an experience. What do you guys feel about it?
Just a second ago while you were talking about it, I realized that it sounds very similar to my earliest memories of why I would turn on a TV or watch, because I didn't understand. I mean, when you were you've gone back to the most base idea of what a film was, because I remember some of the earlier movies that I saw till today, I don't remember anything about the story, but I remembered the car can move by itself. The Love Bug was one of the first movies I ever saw. My earliest memories of it was just being freaked out by the car, by the fact that this car moves by itself, or when you're watching cartoons on television, it's just, I don't even know what the plot. I really didn't even notice that Scooby-Doo and the gang were actually solving mysteries. It was just these things moving around, which were amusing.
Yeah, and it was
fascinating. When you're four or five.
And I remember liking magic shows a lot on TV.
It scared me.
Yeah.
That was real magic.
Well, a few weeks ago on A Bit of Culture, if you two had been listening, you would know. I did a bit on the weirdness of close-ups. Because one of the things following on from what you're saying, Rahma, that when people first went to the movies and they watched a close-up, there were reports of people fainting because the face was so huge,
a giant face, yeah,
on the screen that it was just so overwhelming for people to see these big eyes and looking at you. They never imagined seeing something like that before.
Yeah, the South American natives would be shown pictures of, like, so you have explorers from Holland or something, pictures of, you know, panning down a street in Amsterdam. They say, oh, your houses move. Because to them, it looked as though the houses were moving. They couldn't get the concept of, and also something I read on Twitter today, that the apes, the greater apes, like chimpanzees, orangutans and all that, if you show a movie of another ape, they get really excited. Because it's like, oh, there's another me in there. Or you know, and they watch movies like King Kong. You show them a movie with apes, they get into it. I think, but who knows what's going on in their heads. But something about it is attracting them.
Mm. Recognition. Yeah.
So, like, it's almost like an exhibition of cinema, right? Like, that's what the cinema attraction was. And but at the same time, I think what was interesting during those early years is the acknowledging of the audience. The films were not treated as if, okay, the fourth wall is not there.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to argue that I think it's the same thing today, that although when it comes to these action films and there's a lot of explosives, or, like, you know, it's obviously made for an audience. So it's kind of like subtly breaking that fourth wall.
Yes, but it's made for a very young audience. Like 13-year-old boys specifically. and also this cinema of attraction you're talking about quickly became boring, because when you've seen one train enter a station, or one couple kiss, or a horse running, you know, it's like you've seen them all. And you need to create narrative. I think D.W. Griffith is one of the first to sort of create narrative. There's a famous scene at the beginning of a movie where two generals come out of a tent. Good. One scratches the dog and pats it. The other one comes out and kicks it. It's like, oh, I know which one's the bad guy.
the most basic introduction of...
And you need that to make it interesting. So Fast and the Furious audience will progress, hopefully, onto Godfather Part 2 one day.
I don't know. I mean, I agree it's for kids, but more and more you see people are stuck in it. People are entering their 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s still preferring. But it's not like they don't realize it. They're like, that's all movies are to me. I just want that endorphin hit.
And that is okay. Like, what I'm trying to say is right now, like, acknowledging cinema as a spectacle instead of it just being like an art house medium. You know what I mean?
Right. But also the mobile phone experience.
Yeah.
But the scrolling with the instant hit, that new thing. There was 10 seconds ago, you were looking at a shot of terrible things happening to Palestinians. The next is a puppy, then the kittens, and it's like, it's just
so,
like,
confusing.
Confusing.
Yeah, video games. I mean, you don't want to see what Pac-Man had for breakfast and Pac-Man and Mrs. Pac-Man talking about their lives. You just want to see them eat the pellets and chase the ghosts, right?
That's basically what
things have broken down.
that's what I think.
But I would love that. I would love, you know, this, you know,
I
a day in the life of Mr. and Mrs. Pac-Man.
I know. Yeah, and
as a preamble.
Exactly. And how do they feel about aging? Dietary restrictions. I don't know.
How do you make this pellets taste just a little bit better?
So, Rahma, what's your prediction then? Are we going to just be in a world of explosions and The Rock and
I think we coexist is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
But also, it's now moving to television, right?
The
stories with narratives are moving to streaming.
And what I'm trying to say, like, I mean, the moment I learned about it, like, it made me appreciate these other forms of cinema is what I'm trying to say. Like, I mean, and different movies and different films and different mediums, like, try to accomplish different things for different people.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe some things are just not for me. And this is, like, not me, you know, like, this is trying to, like, excuse myself. Oh, like, I think up to anyone who wants to, like, do this, like, it's up to everyone, whatever that they want to do. You want to, like, watch it for the spectacle, then watch it. Like, it's not that, but at the same time, I can appreciate people liking cinema just for the sake of spectacle. And I guess that's fine.
Well, I guess that's fine. Yeah. Okay. Well, on that patronizing note, we're going to move on. To a final part of the show,
it's,
recommendations.
It's all right now, guys. It's okay.
Yeah.
With
yeah, you can watch things about Explosion.
I guess
that's
fine.
I'll go home and watch
sure.
the entire Fast and Furious collection now because I'm not afraid anymore of being spanked.
So we're going to move on to recommendations. We recommend something that we think might be of interest. I go first. Okay. My recommendation is very simple, which is I was talking earlier about talking to my uncle, and I've been meeting up with my aunt, and I've been, you know, asking about people from the past, and I'm fortunate in the sense that I have this European side, and it is really much easier to chart the past through the internet. But on the Asian side, BU, Malay, Chinese, or Indian, it is very difficult, and you do really require
Chinese, not so. They have the association thing.
You can, but I mean, you know, they actually just mark the people who survived. Well, you know what I mean? There are a lot of people who arrived here anonymous and died in some tin mining pool and left.
Never heard of again.
And I'm very interested in those people too. Even if I just find their name, I just want to look at the name and just sort of feel that somebody has just read their name. And so I want to recommend you just, I think it's nourishing. I think from our conversation earlier, it's beneficial and it's interesting to just sort of find out. So go and ask your family members about your forebears. You know, kids, go ask your grandparents. And the thing is, Nata and I, actually, we could be grandparents now, couldn't we? But we know nothing.
yeah, we could be.
So you got to find people older than us, hopefully. and seriously, just ask them. I mean, they may be telling you not a pack of lies, but stuff that's completely wrong because that's just been handed down. But that's of interest in its own way.
There's only some context, though. You know, it's connected to a place, a time, or so.
Right.
Yeah.
Quite a lot from that.
Oral history is what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's I don't know. It's just worth it. And I think it's fun. I don't know. But that's my recommendation.
Me?
Yeah.
I was given this book called The Hillbilly Elegy. Not allergy, as in like you're allergic to... Elegy, E-L-E-G-Y. Uh-huh. Am I pronouncing it? Elegy.
Elegy. Elegy.
Right? Mm. It's written by J.D. Vance, maybe, because he's American. And it's about the experience of what you would call the Scots-Irish or the hillbillies of Kentucky and surroundings, whatever. Eastern Seaboard. Up in, the Appalachians, which goes quite far, actually.
Yeah.
But it's very interesting because, you know, it breaks all the clichés. I mean, most of us will go like, oh, yeah, don't they all just drive really fast cars like the Dukes of Hazzard? And no, it goes down to the socioeconomic thing, goes back several generations. It's a guy who actually lived that life. And it's interesting because it talks about upward mobility or the lack of it. It talks about values that keep being fostered generation after generation. And it explains a little bit about a portion of the Trumpians, the Trump's people, and why they are that way. And I find it interesting that because nobody's going to write a book about upward mobility in our urban settings, this book actually describes certain things that you could actually put in context for Malaysia. Why is it so difficult for some people, say, some Felda folks, or just anybody, even, you know, in our hometowns like Kuala Kangsa or Ipoh or you know, Butterworth and all that, why upward mobility and just progression is so difficult for so many people to become urban or education can be such a barrier sometimes, or it can be... I'm only about two or three chapters into it, but it's a really good book, really. I mean, you read it and it's in a very fair view of what would be considered something that around the world, everybody has a very low esteem of the hillbillies, you know, and I think every culture has their own hillbilly. Yeah. I'm doing air quotes here, whether you're Malay or Chinese or Indian or whatever. And it's an interesting book. It's called The Hillbilly Elegy by J.D. Vance, I'm assuming it's a very American pronunciation,
right,
about the Scots-Irish.
That's cool. I'll check that out. But if we do want to find out about their allergies, then that's a different
book. And JD is working on it right now. Okay. Yeah. Or people who are allergic
to hillbillies. Oh, I'm sneezing. Why is that? okay, great. And Rahma?
Yeah, so... Oh, my God. Yeah, my suggestion is very simple, actually, because I just finished this amazing, amazing Spanish three-part series. I just watched two parts of the three parts. It's called Money Heist on Netflix.
Oh, yeah, I've seen this name around.
Yeah, make sure that you listen to it in Spanish, because I don't like the English dub. So it's about a group of basically people who did not really have anything to lose. There's a bunch of like criminals who were like trying to run away from the authorities and all that, and they were rounded out by this one guy named Professor, who wanted them to rob the Bank of Spain, where the mint basically. So they were there for like about, I think, like 11 days or something, literally printing money. Wow. Instead of just like, you know, taking all the money, and they were like printing new ones. So they end up with like
undercover or something. They were pretending to be.
No, so they just like went in. So I think.
This isn't a true story.
This is not a true story.
Right. The way you're saying it's like. Okay.
So what's interesting is that it's like, it's literally just about this like few days of them trying to commit this heist. Mm. And what really drove me was how the communication, the backstory of each person, but at the same time, it's just like the planning, the meticulous planning into, oh, you should make sure that the hostage are dressed like us. So the moment they go out, people don't know
who's the hostage. Yeah, and who's
yeah. And if I'm not mistaken, I feel like I've seen a movie like this before, but it's so different. And also, it's about communicating with the authorities and.
So that Denzel Washington.
That is true. Yeah, it is like that. I don't remember the title.
But does it have exploding cars and giant octopuses? Oh, because otherwise, I'm not watching.
You know what? I cannot recall if there was any of that. I guess maybe that's why I like it.
All right. Yeah. And so it's a TV. Three-part.
Yeah, three-part. But so the first two parts right now just concern the heist back of Spain. But if I'm not mistaken, like the third part is they're trying to like rob some other bank. But anyway, it's just like really good, you know, looking at people who do not have anything to lose, who really try to like plan their way out of this bank is fascinating to me, and I really like it.
Sounds
and
cool.
Netflix of Spain is now one of the major suppliers of really good stuff.
Yeah, Netflix.
I just, if anybody from Netflix is listening, all four people in this room can give you really good content, IP, for shows. So you know where to find us, BFM.
Right? We will call them on the bat phone afterwards.
So this one sounds very meticulous, right?
Yeah, like, I love it. Like, I don't know. I didn't know that I was going to like heist movies like this.
Wow, cool. And it's called again?
It's called Money Heist.
Oh, excellent. I'm going to check that one out.
Very, just out, right?
Yeah,
I keep seeing the name. Okay, so that brings us to the end of this week's show. Only remains me now to thank Rahma Pauzi.
Thank you.
And Na'a Murad.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
And
he's Cam Ruslan.
Yeah, I'm Cam Ruslan. I just want to check out, should we say that this show has been truly awful? In the old-fashioned sense.
Oh, you're being so meta.
Okay. Please join us next week for another exciting episode of A Bit of Culture here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.